Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
And today, Richard and I are answering our mail again. Keep your questions coming at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com or after the shows are posted at gamblingwithanedge.com or Richard's on Twitter or just send us an email somehow.
Right. So, I'm on Twitter at RWM21 and you can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/gamblingwithanedge.
Very good. So the following isn't really a question, but it's from a female listener who responded to something we did on a fairly recent show. I'm glad she sent us this. What she said is, a woman asked if it's better to be more attractive or less attractive. I felt both of you squirm a bit. Well, you're right about that. Just calling a lady, identifying my thoughts about her physical appearance is something that is going to get me in trouble more times than not. So she says, you're correct. A plain-looking woman who isn't too unattractive, just average, is better. However, as you correctly pointed out, we can also change it up better than men. If you want to create the impression that this isn't your money, you're just throwing around, a very made-up or fancier look is more important. Sometimes a woman can look like they have a very rich man, letting them throw money around, and it also keeps people from being suspicious. It won't really work in card counting, but many other plays, women can make themselves look rather useless, and it often works. Women will know what that look is because it looks different for different kinds of women. Older women just need bigger hair, longer nails, big fat diamond rings, etc. Younger women need tighter skirts, higher heels. You get the idea. I use it frequently. So thank you for the note. I don't really have a comment on it. Do you, Richard?
No. I obviously, I agree. That's something we talked about. So good. Yeah.
Yeah, it's nice to know we have listeners here.
Yeah.
Okay. His next is a sports question. Wants to know, if games are played on a home field but without crowds, how much would this decrease the home field advantage? My impression is that most of the home field advantage is the social pressure that would put on the referees. If crowds aren't there, then there shouldn't be as much or any social pressure. Sounds right. This isn't my specialty. We can put the question to Frank B, or we have other sporting people here periodically. But I can't tell you if it goes from 3 points to 2 points or anything like that. That's just not my specialty. Richard?
Well, the guys, there were a group of economists who set out to study this, and they had kind of a perfect laboratory back at the times when soccer matches, they were not allowing people in the stands because of hooligans. And so there was a really good episode, or maybe more than one episode, on the podcast Freakonomics, which if you haven't, if you're not familiar with that podcast, it's a great, really interesting podcast. I think most people interested in gambling would find it interesting. And they did a whole series on sports-related questions, and that was one of them. Some sports are there's a bigger effect than others. Some sports, it's almost nothing. But anyway, there is an effect in some sports. So I would say definitely go search out Freakonomics podcasts and find that episode, and you can hear a lot more about it.
Yeah, I'm actually not familiar with that podcast, although I have read two Freakonomics books and highly enjoyed them. I'm was an economics major back in my school days, so I don't know if that makes it more interesting to me than it would be for somebody without that background. Somebody wants to know what you can tell them about blackjack great Peter Griffin. Griffin is not the right word. Peter, is it Griffith?
Griffin. Peter Griffin, yeah.
All right. So now, Anthony Curtis was a friend and published a memoriam when Griffin died in 1998, and we're going to publish that in the show notes. Richard, did you know Peter?
I did. So when he was writing his first book, Theory of Blackjack, when he was writing it the first time, I was a dealer at the Castaways in Las Vegas, which is where the Mirage sits today. And we had $1 four-deck games in the back. We also had single-deck games. I was dealing to this guy, and the single-deck games mostly were $2 tables. And so I'm dealing to this guy, and I realize that he's counting cards right away. And we get to a hand, the first hand of the deck, and he stands with 12 against a 6. And I say to him, "Oh, you better go back and do some more studying. You know, I'm sorry, he hits 12 against a 6. And I say, "You better go back and do some more studying. You know, you're supposed to stand on that hand." And he said, "No, I think you're supposed to hit it." And I said, "No, basic strategy is you're supposed to stand." And he says, "Well, I have a 10 deuce." And I said, "Well, 10 deuce on single deck against a 4 is a hit, but not against a 6. And he says, "Well, according to Peter Griffin's new book, this is one of those fine points of basic strategy. 10 deuce against a 6, single deck, you're supposed to hit." And I said, "Who is Peter Griffin?" And he said, "Well, he's written this new book, Theory of Blackjack." Now, the book was not out yet, right? So, obviously, this was Peter at the table. And so he says, "Oh, well, he's this, you know, mathematics professor from Sacramento who's written this new book called The Theory of Blackjack." And me, being the young smartass that I am, said, "Oh, well, you know, maybe he's, you know, one of these math heads like Thorpe, you know, but doesn't know anything about really playing," which he just thought was hilarious. Whenever he was in town, he would come play at my table. His bet spread was $2 to $8. And he would count, he kept the high opt one and a side count of aces, sevens, eights, the exact number of cards dealt, and the relation of fives to sixes. Because the only determining factor for hitting 16 against a 10 is whether there are more fives or sixes left in the deck, regardless of the count. So, I would deal to him, and I would get down to the last hand, and he would say, "You know, spread the deck. There's 13 cards left, and you have 1, 2, 3, you know, 3 fives, 1 8, 2 sevens, you know." And then I would spread the deck, and we'd count it, and he was always exactly right. So he had a great sense of humor. He was a really fun guy to be around. Another thing that happened with him was, as I said, his bet spread was $2 to $8. But he, one time, there was this bookmaker that I used to deal with to all the time. And he was also a backgammon player, actually. And he happened to be on my game, and Peter came in, and we started talking. And the bookmaker also was a card counter of sorts. And but it wasn't his living. He was mostly a bookmaker, or he might have been a bet runner or both. But anyway, at some point I introduced them, and I said, "Oh, this is Peter Griffin." By that time, I think his book had come out, and so he ended up backing Peter to go play for substantial stakes which Peter did for some time, won a lot of money that way, but he was not really comfortable betting big money. But anyway, yeah, he was a great guy. He died far too young.
Yeah, and he was not above talking to the little guy. I remember the first time I met Anthony Curtis, or one of the first times, I was still a red chip blackjack player and going for casino rebates. And I mentioned to Anthony that I would try to play on games where they had side bets. And I would avoid the side bets, but most of the players would take them, which would slow down the game. So I would get fewer hands per hour. And since my advantage was in the rebate, not in the actual, I was playing a break-even game about, but the rebate is per hour, that the fewer hands I played made it a positive EV. And Peter was gracious and said, you know, that's a smart play. That's a good idea. And so, and I was just a nobody, still am, I guess, in blackjack. And I was really flattered by that. And he was never too busy to talk to a little guy. All right, let's move on. Somebody wants to know about drawings. And the question is, when the changeover from physical to virtual drawing entries, has that had any effect on my play or my results? And my answer is that I keep a column in my daily log for winnings at drawings, but I don't separately annotate whether it was a live drawing or virtual drawing or drawings where I didn't win anything. So I don't have any good data on how this has affected my results. With that said, I much, much prefer virtual drawings. Sometimes in some promotions, I will have had lots of tickets. And some needed to be filled out by hand. Some rules say you cannot use stickers or rubber stamps. And it's a tedious, time-consuming job. A play that was $100 an hour becomes a $70 an hour job if you have to stop and fill in the tickets. And if you fail to fill in the tickets, the game might not even be worth anything per hour. So I like the virtual tickets, and they like me, I guess. Have you had many casino drawings, Richard?
No, I haven't.
It's hard to do that when you won't give them your name, huh?
Yeah, although, you know, we have a mutual friend who was one of the very first people to get into video poker and advantage slots back 30 years ago or whatever. And more than 30 years ago, but I remember playing a progressive at Palace Station, and this was slot machines, and it was with coins where you had to feed the coins in and your hand got all black, and I just, you know, it was the worst gambling I've ever done in my life, but I did end up winning a car in a drawing because of it. But yeah, I haven't been in many drawings.
All right. Another question. This relates to COVID. It says, in light of the endless lockdown we're faced with in this country, would like to pose a question that might be timely. Do you think when the casinos open up again, they would consider non-smoking only? We're going to have a new normal anyway. Let's start by clearing the air. And my response to that is neither Richard nor I are smokers and actually would prefer the air being cleaner in casinos. I'm not optimistic that it's going to happen soon in Las Vegas. There's a high correlation between people who smoke and people who gamble. and people who do other destructive habits. Most experiments in Vegas with non-smoking areas have left the casinos unhappy with the overall result. So it'd be nice, but I don't think it's going to happen. Richard?
Yeah, I mean, I've said for a long time, smoking is one of the worst parts about this whole business. But they're not going to do anything that's going to inhibit people from coming back. You know, they need people back in the door. They've lost too much money, and there's just no way I think they would do that now, much as I wish they would.
All right. Somebody read an article about Don Johnson, who negotiated a 20% rebate on Atlantic City casinos after the 2008 financial crisis. Don has been on our show a few times, and he has talked about that. So the question is, do they think more opportunities like this will emerge after the lockdown? And my answer to that is, Don Johnson definitely negotiated such a deal, but it wasn't an opportunity that emerged. It was an opportunity he created for himself. Whether you can create such an opportunity for yourself depends more on your negotiating and salesmanship skill than it does on the pandemic. My published prediction is that things will be tighter when casinos open up again. Obviously, each casinos are different, and some will do it one way and some will do it another, but we'll see. As a state, Nevada has had a comparatively low number of COVID cases and deaths. While this is good for us so far, it also means the percentage of people who've developed antibodies from having the disease is relatively low. When we open up the casinos to people from all over, the predicted pandemic in the fall will very possibly strike Nevada harder than places that have had a lot more cases and deaths so far. Many experts say it's going to be 2 or 3 years before the world develops enough of a herd immunity. And that actually makes sense to me. The politicians who claim that we'll be back to normal by midsummer does not make so much sense to me. But it's a guess. It's and unfortunately, the predictions about life and death have now become a political thing, with Democrats believing one thing and Republicans believing another, where this is not something that should be a partisan divide.
Yeah, I think these things are cyclical. Yes, Don negotiated that deal for himself, but I mean, he didn't negotiate it out of the blue. I mean, this is something that they do for big players, or did. And as I say, these things are cyclical. They start giving something away. Somebody spanks them real hard. They take it away. You know, but some years down the road, some new management team comes in and says, I know how we're going to get high rollers in here. We're going to give them a rebate. You know, they do it in Asia all the time. And, you know, it'll come back. And there aren't that many people out there who take advantage of it. So, you know, when they do come back, they can last a while. But you have to... you have to go ask. I mean, you have to get a deal for yourself. They're not just going to offer it.
And sometimes you have to ask in another way after the first way didn't work, and then in another way, and then offer them something if they'll offer you something. It's a there's an art to this. This is not something that is easy to do. Getting good offers like that is...
well, that is the game. I mean, for a lot of people, not a lot of people, but for some professionals, that is their edge, is getting these kinds of things, right? Mm-hmm. So learning to, you know, I've said a lot, it's easy to learn how to count cards. It's hard to learn how to take out the money. And, you know, this is probably harder to learn than counting cards. But because once you make the deal, then you got to figure out how to best take advantage of it. And usually the best idea is not to count cards to take advantage of it.
Yeah. And I'm sure that the Don Johnson was not counting cards when this went on. And he will tell you there might have been something else going on that's more than lost rebates. But he won't tell you any more than that. Someone has extra time during this pandemic and has been trying to learn about loss rebates. Wants to know if there's a loss rebate calculator out there that one can use. Richard, do you know of any?
Well, yeah, but it's not available to the public. Yeah, I think there are several people who have made these. Obviously, you know, James Grosheen obviously made the first one. He talks about loss rebates in his book, Exhibit CAA, which, you know, everything is in that book. So, yeah, publicly available. I am not aware of any publicly available loss rebate calculator.
Okay. When you were talking about Peter Griffin, you mentioned deck composition of 10-2 versus a 4 versus 10-2 versus a 6. And somebody actually wanted to know the best reference book for learning how to factor hand composition into his play. I'm assuming that's Peter Griffin's book, but you may have a different answer.
Well, first of all, I'm assuming you're talking about single deck because, you know, on a six deck shoe, it's meaningless. But for single deck, actually, I think there is a I think there are lists of the basic strategy composition dependent plays at Wizard of Oz. So you can just go there. I remember playing single deck when you used to be able to play single deck at online casinos. You know, we would just have the chart open on a browser in front of us to give us all the two-card, three-card composition-dependent plays. I'm sure it's still there.
Are they in effect, even if you're counting, do the deck composition things, like the 10-2 versus a 4, is that have a an index number on it, or?
Well, I mean, that's why it's a composition-dependent play. So, for example, 10 deuce against a 6, your count, if you're using high-low, is plus 1, which normally you would be standing against a 4 or a 6. But because you have a 10 in your hand, your 12 is – it's not as bad to be hitting your 12. So it's correct to hit against a 4 or a 6. Well, and obviously against a 2 or a 3 as well.
Uh-huh. All right. We're now going to take a commercial break. And we have more questions that we're going to get to as soon as we come back. The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%, which are currently all locked up because the casino is not open. When it will open is anybody's guess. Some people are predicting May 15th. Some are predicting June 1st. Your guess is as good as mine. Whether or not we have free video poker classes in the fall this year, again, has not been determined. This is pretty much what the casino wants to do. At predicted.org, there's a market where you can place small bets on the occurrence of various political events. Mostly, but not entirely, in the United States. The most active markets now are who can be nominees for vice president and who's going to win the various states. Whether Trump or Biden is going to be the winner varies daily, partly determining about how people respond to Trump's handling of the coronavirus. And also how people are responding to the sexual harassment allegations against Biden. So those are going up and down. If you have a strong opinion one way or the other, you can make a bet. Gambling with an Edge listeners receive a one-time offer of a deposit match up to $20 at predicted.org/promo.edge. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. An additional membership, the Pro membership, is sold separately, $6.95 a month or $49.95 a year. There's a combination price if you also have the Gold membership. Listeners can try this out. You can play 1,000 hands for free at videopoker.com/GWAE. The biggest advantage of this software is that it corrects you on both Quick Quads and Ultimate X in a way that is not available elsewhere. Just the correction they give you on other games is different than what is done on Video Poker for Winners or any of the other available software. Whether or not that's to your liking or not is kind of up to you. I find it useful information. But you may or may not. Let's go back to our questions. Somebody's wondering if Richard and I will travel for good opportunity when casinos reopen. Richard?
Certainly not right away. No. Yeah, it'll be a while before I go back to a casino. But, I'm fortunate in that I don't have to get out there and earn right now. So, if I was hurting for money, it might be a different story. But, I won't be.
And for me, Richard is more retired than I am. So as a player, I'm not retired at all, but even before this situation, I've been traveling a lot less than I used to due to non-gambling activities I participated in Las Vegas. Insofar as when I go back to the casinos, count me in as a chicken. I have, no reason to believe that Dr. Fauci's prediction that the pandemic will resume in the fall is a wrong one. That said, eventually I hope to return to cruising and take into occasional travels related to gambling or not. When that's going to be, I don't know. Another question. I was wondering what kind of arrangements APs make for trading info. If I find out about a good opportunity that I won't be able to take advantage of, can I offer that information to somebody else for a finder's fee? Or is it mostly done in good faith that the other person will share similar opportunities in the future? Richard.
Well, I've done both. In terms of the finder's fee, I am unwilling to just pay some amount of money for information, because, you know, you can end up traveling halfway across the country and you get there and the game's no longer there or whatever. So usually the kind of deal, that I make is, I take a percentage of the action, win or lose, right? So if I give somebody a game that they're going to go play, I say, hey, I'd like, 20% of your action, win or lose, because they could now fly halfway across the country and the game is burned out or whatever, and they're stuck for their expenses. And you have to talk about all that as well, like what expenses are included in the, in the final tally. So and sometimes I've just given games to people and said, here, good luck. With the hope that they may do the same for me someday or whatever.
Yeah, I've done both those things too. I've been burned.
Yeah, that certainly happens.
But most of the ones I give away are done for free to good friends. Like I would give if I found out something that was that I thought Richard or one of his family members might appreciate, you know, I'll drop a dime pretty quickly. There's a few other people who I would share with like that, and some of them have shared back. And often you hear about games that the person didn't really know they were sharing with you. Like I'm going to make up something that does not exist. So don't go running to check it out. There have been times when people say, you know, did you see about the $5 progressive at Arizona Charlie's Decatur? You know, and I'm sometimes would lie and say, yeah, I know about that. And then they'll talk something about it. And often I will go check it out and it may or may not be a good play. But that's, and by the way, I know of no good $5 plays at Arizona Charlie's Decatur. That was just an example. But that is a place that is 10 miles or so away from my house. And checking it out is not that inconvenient. If somebody told me, you know, just speculative, like there might be a good game in Iowa somewhere, I would not be really anxious to hop on a plane to do that. All right, next question is for Richard. Wants to know, like you've mentioned quite a few times, that usually when you leave a casino, you do not cash out your chips on the same day you played. So assuming you're not going to be back in that casino, in that area for a while, what do you do?
Well, what I do is I take them with me. I know some people don't have the bankroll to do that. They don't have the connections to trade them with other people. But in my case, I take them with me. And, you know, some players hang on to chips for years. You know, this is a bigger problem for players who play for bigger stakes, because you also want the chips because of CTR restrictions, right? You find a really great game, you don't want to only be able to get in 10,000 and then you have to stop because they're going to demand ID for a CTR. Whereas if you have 20,000 in chips in your pocket going in, you have a lot more leeway.
So even if you weren't expecting to go back to a place for forever, essentially, you would still keep them?
Well, I mean, forever, no, probably not. Like, for example, if I went to Europe or something, I would definitely cash out. But if it's in the U.S., I mean, forever is a long time. And I also have the benefit of knowing a lot of active players that I might be able to say, hey, I have these chips for wherever, you know, can you use them?
So do you have, I assume, Nelia has instructions of, if I drop dead, then this is where my stash is located in this safety deposit box, and talk to James Grossjean about da 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 da. I assume you have arrangements, something like that of nature.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
But it's not, so he says, of course, but it's not trivial. If you don't have, now Richard has been married for, I don't know, 30 years or so, and, and expects that relationship to continue. Many of our listeners are unmarried or in relationships where they don't have a special somebody. And so them keeping, you know, having a safe full of however much, you know, that nobody's going to know how to do with it. If they, when they have a brother-in-law open up the safe after death, that a good chance that brother-in-law will have no idea how to, what to do with all this stuff. So you need to have that information there. All right. In one of our recent shows, where we answer listener questions, there was this quarter player who played 45 minutes at the Borgata in Atlantic City on 9-6 jacks or better. And he received 0 points total. Could not figure out why the machine was stiffing him. One listener, so I posited an idea, which, and another listener with more knowledge of the MLI system than I have said that as she understands it, the MLI system at the Borgata does not record any result that doesn't recognize in at least a $10 theoretical loss. So if, for example, on a playing for 45 minutes for quarters, let's say the guy played $1,000 coin in. That's much faster than many people play. Not a record by any stretch, but it's easier to do the math on 45 on $1,000 coin in. Since 9-6 jacks is 99.544, playing $1,000 coin in, if you played perfectly, the casino would expect to make $4.56, which would be well below the $10 theoretical loss figure. So this strikes me as a plausible explanation. I don't know it for sure, but it would explain why playing on a loose game for quarters for 45 minutes would give you nothing. All right. So that's the end of our current listener questions, although I do have more in the recommended area than we usually do. So I'm going to start sharing more recommendations than we usually have, and maybe that will take us up so we end up with a full show. One is, I'm on Professor I. Nelson Rose's email list, I guess. And recently got an email that he was interviewed on a podcast called Be Better Betters, which is run by Spanky, who is a sports bettor out of New Jersey, who's been on our show a couple times. So I listened to the podcast. I learned some stuff from it. So I think that particular episode anyway is good for our listeners. And I don't mind giving a shout out at all to Spanky's podcast. Another thing I would like to recommend has to do with public libraries. The Las Vegas system is closed for going inside of it, but its electronic system still works 24/7. They have hundreds of thousands of ebooks, which are downloadable if nobody else has it checked out. And if you have a Kindle or other such device, you can download titles to your Kindle 24/7 and read to your heart's content. The advantage to this over checking out books is you don't have to worry if the last person who checked out the Kindle was sickly or not, because that those germ the virus won't be spread across the Kendall situation. So other than Las Vegas, I'm not familiar with the libraries in your hometown, but it wouldn't surprise me that several have similar ideas where this ebook kind of thing is available.
Yeah, there's also something called the National Emergency Library. And if you just Google National Emergency Library, it's at archive.org. And so it's a national library full of stuff. So it's another place where if you're not finding what you're looking for at your local library, you might try that. And the other thing that's great about you know, the library systems are it's not just books. You can also get movies and music. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff there.
So on this national one, are these ebooks you're talking about, or do they actually mail you copies of books?
No, it's ebooks.
Very good.
Yeah. You know, I would also say during this time of quarantine, I've sort of been renewing my love of photography. So I have been somebody, you know, more than a month ago, started some Facebook thing where they were saying, you know, just post a landscape. You don't have to say anything about it. Just put a landscape on your Facebook page. So I started more than a month ago. And so every day I've just been putting up a photograph of somewhere I've been, a photograph that I liked. And I put it on the Gambling with an Edge Facebook page as well as my own. And so, yeah, it just kind of has renewed my love of photography. It's made me get out with my camera, although I've been posting more pictures from, you know, places I've traveled, but some pictures from around Vegas as well. So I don't know. If you have any interest in that, you can check out the Gambling with an Edge Facebook page.
On a recent show, we recommended the Masterclass series of lectures, and on photography, there's a course by Annie Leibovitz, who is, of course, a quite celebrated photographer. I'm assuming her class was one of the first ones you took. Was it good?
It was good. Actually, yes, it was the first class I took. And there's also one by a National Geographic photographer who climbs mountains and takes a lot of pictures in the mountains, and I took his class as well. That was pretty interesting. And I've been taking a lot of the all of the writing and movie classes, you know. So, yeah, currently I'm in the David Mamet writing class, and you know, he's kind of pompous, but yeah, I'm still enjoying it. So,
well, he's on screenplays, isn't he? He's on movies, isn't he?
Well, he talks about, you know, he started as a playwright, and so he talks about screenplays, but he talks about playwriting as well.
So, I've done all the writing ones, including that one, and didn't relate to as well about that as I have some of the others, but I especially like the David Baldacci writing class and the John Grisham writing class and the Malcolm Gladwell writing class. So they're all different. On the poker classes that they have there, there are two Hall of Famers. They've written one was is Danny Negreanu, and one was is Phil Ivey. So they're very different, and for my case, I have read Daniel Negreanu's writing for years. He's been very prolific in both books and blogs in various places, and has been on our show twice. Thank you very much. But Phil Ivey has been a real quiet guy. He hasn't published very much of what he knows. And so Interestingly, on examples from real life games that he shows, Phil shows some examples where he screwed up or he made the wrong play. And not that it turned out wrong, but it was the wrong play. And he uses that as learning expertise, where most of the examples Daniel used are where Daniel made the right play. And so, but this masterclass series is currently 2-for-1. And we should make them a sponsor, because I can't say enough good things about them. The final thing I would want to say as a recommendation is for Sudoku players. Sudoku is the 9x9 matrix where divided up into 9 3x3 tic-tac-toe squares where you put the numbers 1 through 9 and they have to be different. The online is a extremesudoku.info, which puts 5 really difficult Sudoku problems every day. They named them evil, excessive, egregious, excruciating, and extreme. Now, I have found them at approximately the right level for me. There are some that most I can get through successfully, some I can't. But there's 5 of them, which is, takes a while, but not all day. There are archives. You can spend your life there if you want to. But so as an occasional break, I will go and solve one of these high level tough ones for free. And that's where I get them. And with that, I am going to say thank you, Richard. And go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.